mind should start with all the 11 rak'at of midnight prayers, the 11 units. Even if the child is doing only one unit, that is Salatul Witr, that is the only one, that is only of one rak'ah, only one unit, I think even that is sufficient. And it's not necessary that the child goes ahead with all the 300 al-afw and example 70 times astaghfirullah.
I used to watch this TV program in Qom itself in the Ramadan time, wherein the anchor used to insist that it's still, you know, it's still 15 minutes up to the morning prayers. Just go and offer two unit prayers.
Amazing.
So yeah, like the way he insisted and the way he was telling that even two unit prayer can be counted.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. So like just for 2 to 3 minutes or maybe 5 minutes. This is how good things are started. Yeah.
Yeah. Started because some people are scared that I don't know the zikr and maybe it's some. 11 rak'at and all, so maybe I won't be able to.
Yeah.
So you can actually shorten it and ask the scholars and research on that.
Exactly.
So thank you, brother. That was all the time we had for today's episode. I want to narrate here the incident of Allama Tabatabai when he went to Najaf and he was busy in studying there. He meets one of his teachers, Qazi Sharfiab, and then he tells him, my dear son, he says that, Allama Tabatabai says that he put his hand on my shoulders and said, my dear son, if you want dunya, if you want this world, then pray Salat al-Layl. And if you want akhirat, the hereafter, then also pray Salat al-Layl, that is the midnight prayers. So that is the importance of midnight prayers. We also have in many riwayat, many of the narrations that midnight prayers do bring sustenance and a lot of risk in the form of like maybe knowledge, maybe traveling and maybe children or maybe any other form. So Salat al-Layl definitely has both the world and the hereafter. Thank you for tuning in. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another episode, take good care. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
The similarities between us. Take a minute and see yourself in the mirror. You look like me. Those eyes, lips, you can't deny. Have you thought about why we look the same? Why we feel the same? Don't tell me it's by chance. Oh, you're my brother. wish you could realize there's no difference between us two. We're part of one family, no matter how far you are. And even if we don't know each other,
a warm greeting to our dear listeners wherever you may be listening from. This is Iran Radio from the heart of Iran's vibrant capital, Tehran. Straightly, we go to the interesting facts about Islam. During the Golden Age of Islam, Muslims created a house of wisdom, or Baitul Hikmah, which was active during the 9th and 13th century, where both Muslims and non-Muslims scholars sought to translate the world's knowledge into Arabic. Many classic works of antiquity that might have otherwise been lost were preserved in Arabic and Persian and later translated into Turkish, Hebrew, and Latin. Here, scholars synthesized and significantly advanced knowledge gained from the Persian, Roman, Chinese, Egyptian, Greek, Byzantine, and Phoenician civilizations. Muslim scholars like Ibn Rushd and Avicenna were primarily responsible for saving the works of prominent Greek philosopher Aristotle. For this hour, we have Spotlight. Then we have Bridge, connecting you to sacred supplications. This program presents a brief commentary and presentation of the supplications from the Noble Book of Sahifa As-Sajadiyya. Sahifa As-Sajadiyya is a collection of 54 supplications and prayers dedicated by Imam Sajjad, Shia's fourth Imam, peace be upon him. Then we have another segment of radio productions. Up next is a Spotlight. Stay tuned.
Us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. Israel's near daily airstrikes on Lebanon, which have killed many civilians despite a ceasefire in place, are heightening fears of a wider war. Beirut warns that a full-scale Israeli attack may be imminent as regional and international actors have sounded the alarm as well. Analysts caution that without urgent diplomacy, the confrontation could spiral into a devastating and widespread regional conflict.
Lebanon's foreign minister has warned of imminent all-out Israeli attack on the Arab country. Youssef Raji said Beirut has received warnings from Arab and international parties that Israel is preparing for a large-scale military operation against Lebanon. He said Lebanon is intensifying diplomatic contacts to shield the country and its vital facilities from the potential strikes. The remarks come in the wake of a fresh round of Israeli airstrikes on Lebanese soil. On Friday, regime's warplanes carried out at least a dozen attacks across the country. The regime claimed that the attacks targeted Hezbollah sites and rocket launchers. However, witnesses said the strikes hit civilian sites and open fields. Despite the ceasefire agreement signed between Israel and Lebanon in November 2024, Israeli airstrikes have continued almost daily, with little respite. The regime also maintains troops in five areas in South Lebanon. This persistent aggression has sparked international condemnation, particularly from the United Nations. A UN report published this month revealed that at least 127 Lebanese civilians, including children, have been killed since the ceasefire took effect. The UN has characterized these ongoing strikes as potential war crimes. Many believe that the attacks aim at pressuring Hezbollah movement to lay down its arms and reach a new deal with the Lebanese government. However, the group has ruled out any new agreement with Israel, saying that intimidation will not change Hezbollah's stance of resistance. It says U.S. and Israel's calls for disarmament are designed to weaken Lebanon and leave it exposed to external aggression. Analysts warn that the escalating confrontation risks plunging the region into a wider conflict with devastating consequences. For now, Lebanon's leadership and resistance insist that only diplomacy and international pressure can avert a full-scale war.
Well, here are our guests for tonight's edition of Spotlight. Activist and commentator Mick Napier joining us from Glasgow. And we also have journalist and political commentator Leila Hatoum joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Welcome to the program, to both my guests. Let's start off with Ms. Hatoum in Beirut. Now, Lebanon's foreign minister has warned of an imminent all-out Israeli attack on the Arab country, and that Beirut has received warnings from Arab and international parties that Israel is preparing for this large-scale military operation. Why is the Israeli regime continuing to seek escalation while it's in a supposed ceasefire with Lebanon?
You have to understand one thing. When the Israelis threaten, that means they're not going to do any action. When they want to do action, they directly do it. So the escalation that we've been seeing over the past 11 to 12 months along our border, since the signing of, it's been a year, since the cessation of hostilities agreement between Lebanon and the Israeli occupation, the Israelis have been breaching it on a daily basis. 2 months ago, they said that they're going to escalate their aggression against Lebanon, and they didn't care, and this is what they did. Daily aggressions. In fact, less than 2 hours ago, before I came over to the studio, the Israeli occupation opened fire through one of their frigates against one of our, basically what you call a fisherman's boat, and then they threw a sound grenade against one of the fishermen in his boat in the sea off the coast of Ras al-Makura, that's in basically southern Lebanon's western sector. So having said that, the Israelis, nothing stops them if they want to do something. When they threaten openly, it means they are not going to do anything, and they're trying to create pressure, fear-mongering, to push the Lebanese towards either trying to disarm the resistance or put more pressure on the resistance internally so that the resistance doesn't do any action. Also, you have to remember another thing. The Israelis don't fight during winter time. That's why most of their agreements happen around the months of October or November, because they don't fight during December and January. You just look throughout their history. They can't do a wide-scale escalation on the ground during winter time. So what they can do is, like, they continue to bombard us by warplanes, and this is what they're doing on a daily basis.
All right, let's bring in Mr. Napier as well. Mick Napier, Israeli jets have recently carried out more than a dozen strikes in South Lebanon. The Israeli military claims it hit Hezbollah training sites, but witnesses say that the strikes hit civilian sites and open fields. Now, in that regard, the Hezbollah chief just last week said Israeli attacks have nothing to do with Hezbollah's weapons, and rather it's the expansionist regime seeking to lay the groundwork for Lebanon's gradual occupation and initiating the Greater Israel Project through the Lebanese front. Do you see it in that light as well?
Israelis do and say since 48 makes sense of that conclusion. And Israel's got the Zionist project has a built-in DNA of expansionism, of appropriating more and more territory. Some of them now are talking about dividing Syria and seizing the land and incorporating the land that they seized into the Israeli state, as they did with the Golan. So this expansionism is nothing new, and the Israelis talk about it openly. What I think is interesting, though, is in a very sophisticated and detailed analysis from our guest in Beirut, is that when the Israelis talk about they've got an attack on the Lebanese resistance, everything they say belies that, because they even discuss in their staff colleges, and they discuss openly the so-called Dahiya doctrine, named after the suburb of southern suburb of Beirut, which they devastated in a previous attack. And by that they mean, and they say this very explicitly, they will respond to resistance by resistance forces by destroying civilian infrastructure, by exacting a price. Now, this is a war crime, clearly a war crime, but they reckon that with Donald Trump in the White House, they have an even greener light than they had from Biden. And I think it's interesting, I would put it no higher, it's interesting that the same week and days that Trump is seizing tankers off the coast of Venezuela, escalating to outright banditry Israel attacks Lebanese fishing boats and so on. I think that they've got a green light from Washington, not just in words, but actually in action. So what the Lebanese, of course, expect from Israel is no mercy, that they have to resist, they have to fight back. The whole record of every Israeli attack on Lebanon from 1982, 2000 and so on, the occupation of the south for, was it 20 years, shows that the only thing that will make Lebanon, will preserve Lebanon as an independent state, is the most determined and sadly very costly resistance by Hezbollah and other resistance forces. Israel is brutal, committed to massacring Lebanese civilians. It's part of their military doctrine, and I think Lebanese know that as well.
Leila Hatoum, Lebanon's leadership and the resistance insists that for now, only diplomacy and international pressure can avert a full-scale war. But since the truce took effect back in November of 2024, Israel has violated the agreement on an almost daily basis, leaving more than 340 people killed. So diplomacy has never been a language that the Israelis understood, has it? And in addition to that, what about the inaction of the guarantors to this ceasefire?
All right, I'll start with the last thing first. When the guarantors to this ceasefire are the same ones who are supplying the Israeli occupation with weapons and international impunity, to what extent do you think that these guarantors are going to hold their word in terms of basically protecting Lebanon or banning the Israelis from actually breaching that ceasefire? The cessation of hostilities agreement that was signed on the 26th of November 2024 and came into effect on November 27th, 2024, and basically fully came into effect around January 26th, 2025, hasn't been respected by the Israeli occupation since then until today. More than 5,000 breaches to that cessation of hostilities on part of the Israeli occupation had been witnessed and documented even by the United Nations interim forces in South Lebanon. The United Nations even called it war crimes and basically a breach of that ceasefire. So basically, we cannot rely on these guarantors to get us anywhere. When it comes to international diplomacy, you also have to understand one thing, that international diplomacy has done nothing for Lebanon since 1948 until today, because the Israeli occupation continued to occupy Lebanese territories, not from 1948, but actually from 1945, when they occupied parts of Hunin, the outskirts of Hunin, and they started building their basically Miskav Am settlement, among other settlements over there. So, having looked into this whole situation, since when also did the Israelis respect any of the cessation of hostilities or agreements, or even the armistice agreement that we signed with them since 1949? The Israelis breached it seven times between 1949 and 1967, before the Israelis themselves actually targeted Lebanon and occupied most of its southern parts in the 1967 war, which Lebanon had no hand in it. The Israelis were fighting with the Jordanians, the Syrians, and the Egyptians at the time. Lebanon had no hand in that war, and still they actually targeted Lebanon, which was the first country to sign an armistice agreement with them. Since then until today, the Israelis continue to aggress Lebanon. International diplomacy does nothing. By 2006, both parties agreed to the 1701 UN Security Council resolution. The Israelis should have actually withdrawn from southern Lebanese territories, but they didn't. They continued to breach that resolution nearly 3,000 times between 2006 and 2023 until this whole, what you call, aggression on Lebanon and the fighting started. It's a full-scale war and war crime against Lebanon. So again, if the international guarantors are not going to respect their word, and they haven't shown us any example in the past to respect their word, if the Israelis are not going to respect their word, and that shows us throughout history that they never respected any of the agreements we signed with them, then basically we have no other choice. When it comes to the leadership of the resistance, as well as the Lebanese leadership, and I'm speaking about the president himself, they have the same point. The Israelis have to withdraw from Lebanon and stop threatening us and
right.
stop targeting us. Otherwise, resistance is our rightful right under international law.
Mick Napier, the United Nations has characterized the ongoing strikes as potential war crimes. We know last week the Lebanese president met with the delegation from the Security Council in Beirut, urging the Security Council to pressure Israel to respect the ceasefire, withdraw from Lebanon. Apparently that didn't work. So the UN has done nothing with regards to any of the Israeli violations in Lebanon, also the daily massacres in Gaza. How does this reflect on the credibility of the UN when it seems so helpless in the face of Israeli violations?
You know, there was a time when the UN and even the US would condemn Israel. Our guest will remember the year, it escapes me at the moment. I think in the 60s or 70s, when Palestinians hijacked an Israeli aircraft, Israel attacked Beirut Airport and destroyed the Lebanese civilian aircraft fleet quite deliberately. Now, at that time, the US criticized them and the UN criticized them, but they didn't do anything about it. They didn't impose any sanctions. But today, we don't even hear a word of criticism. There never has been a word of criticism. All we hear is of, and it's quite consistent, by the way, Hamas savages, Hezbollah savages, wonderful Israeli troops who are the greatest moral army in the world. Reality is turned on its head every single day and every single report. Look, I don't think your viewers understand the barbarity of past Israeli attacks on Lebanon. In 1982, my God, the Los Angeles Times reported Israeli vehicles, Israeli big trucks, were stealing Lebanese cars and taking them off to Israel. They stole the computer system from Beirut Airport. They stole the contents of libraries, and they devastated cultural centers in Lebanon. So the banditry and the extreme levels of savagery and contempt for the UN are very telling. Another thing, by the way, that happened in 1982 was, and the Israeli newspapers reported this, when a UN committee was coming to the city that was occupied, an Arab capital occupied by the Israeli military, shortly before the massacres of Sabra and Shatila, a UN committee came to the city, and the Israeli military on that day shelled the center of Beirut with high explosive shells, killing a lot of people, and the Israeli newspapers understood the joke. They shelled the city at 2:42, 18 minutes to 3, and 3:38, the numbers of the UN resolutions that attempted to constrain Israeli criminality. And the Israeli newspaper said, yes, that the joke was obvious. So Israel has demonstrated its contempt for the United Nations in Lebanese blood by massacring people in order to send a message. So it seems to me, when you look at the record, no crime, the devastation of Dahiya, the Israelis openly talking about the Dahiya doctrine. This is what they will impose if they have to go into Lebanon. And all these other examples of extreme criminality and contempt for the United Nations, that tells us what Israel thinks of the UN.
Leila Hatoum, on the issue of the disarmament of the Lebanese resistance, we know the Israeli regime maintains troops in five areas in South Lebanon, occupying those regions. You just mentioned earlier that the government should be focused more on issues like ending the Israeli occupation and the regime's daily attacks. So why is the Lebanese government pursuing such a self-harming path? And who would actually benefit from Hezbollah's disarmament?
Well, unfortunately for us, the Lebanese government is inactive and it's unwilling to confront the Israeli occupation. Furthermore, we have some elements in main positions inside the government who are adamant at relinquishing Lebanon's right to resist, despite the fact that it has been ensured to every population and country in this world under international law. So at the end of the day, when you look at the situation, we do have some elements that kind of what you call execute an Israeli-American agenda in Lebanon, and then they claim it's under what you call trying to maintain Lebanon's sovereignty. In that sense, when you have our foreign affairs minister going out, all out and about to justify the Israeli occupation's aggression on Lebanon, and that happened a few months back, and everybody had criticized him on that, it means that he is complicit one way or another, even as a foreign affairs minister, in terms of giving the Israelis the upper hand to use his words against Lebanon. I have never seen a minister throughout history, unless they were appointed by an occupation, justify for the occupation the what you call atrocities and war crimes committed against his own people. So at the end of the day, when I look at what's happening on the ground, the government is facilitating continued Israeli aggressions on Lebanon by not arming the Lebanese army, or at least using diplomacy, as they call it. If they think that diplomacy is going to work wonders for them, why don't they use diplomacy to arm the Lebanese army? We heard the Americans very loud and clear through their envoy to the region and basically their ambassador in Turkey, Tom Barrack, when he said, we're not going to arm the Lebanese army to fight the Israelis. We want to arm it to fight its own people and disarm the resistance. So at the end of the day, when you look at the whole situation, I do believe that the this government, at least, will not be able to do anything. It's a transitional government. They will not be able to disarm the resistance for a reason. The resistance will not lay down its arms so long that there is an occupation. The president himself, who has very what you call mitigated decisions, not decisions, but positions in certain points, he was very adamant and clear when he said that we cannot achieve peace so long that the Israeli occupation continues to occupy Lebanese territories and continue to aggress the Lebanese.
Meek Napier, about the greater Israel scheme, Benjamin Netanyahu and many other right-wing ministers have openly talked about the quote-unquote vision of a greater Israel, and they constantly brag about the expansionist project. What does this mean, not just for Palestinians, but for the entire region? And who are the main obstacles to an Israeli occupation spanning across West Asia?
That's the $64 million question. The Israelis have made it abundantly clear they don't see the current borders of so-called Israel as in any way permanent. They're only a temporary thing to be expanded going forward. But you know, they cannot even attempt this without the US backing. You know, a settler colonial project like the Jewish supremacist state in Palestine, it necessarily is at war with its neighbors, because they're killing Arabs in Gaza, in the West Bank, in Lebanon, because they are Arabs. And, you know, that doesn't play well with the people in neighboring societies, neighboring countries. So it's got a built-in instability where there's inevitably hatred and anger towards Israel. But that's not allowed to come out because the local governments inhibit it. But it's a permanent situation. If you look at South Africa, for example, before white supremacy was defeated, they devastated neighboring countries, Angola, Mozambique, Rhodesia, and so on, because they had to, in a sense, before they were defeated. And I think it's the lessons of history is, for the people of the region, there's a terrible price to be paid for this Zionist project until it is defeated and put in the dustbin of history. So the lessons are there. And I think this the Israeli attitude to Lebanon is also colored by their need to assert what they call their deterrent edge. That means they have to be able to terrorize all their neighbors with the conclusion that they cannot resist the Israeli juggernaut. And because they failed to exterminate the resistance in Gaza, which is absolutely astonishing, because they actually failed in their war aims in Gaza, and they failed to defeat the Yemenis, they failed to defeat the Lebanese resistance, they feel a need. Because remember, There are 6 or 7 million Zionist Jews in Israel-Palestine at the moment, and they're surrounded by 600 million people who can see what's going on. In order for them to survive, they need terror, state terror, continuous and unending state terror. And that will be the reality, I'm afraid, for the people of Lebanon and Palestine and Jordan and Syria and Iraq and Yemen, as long as the Zionist project continues with an airlift of weapons, 2,000-pound bombs and money and so on, from Washington and from Europe.
Sure. Leila Hatoum, the so-called Greater Israel map includes Egypt, Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, and in some illustrations, Saudi Arabia and even Kuwait. How has the silence and lack of proper action and outrage from other Arab countries further emboldened the Israelis? Who's to say that the Israelis won't set their sights on more Arab land in the future?
Who said that they wouldn't? I'll tell you some funny story that happened to me a few months back. When Netanyahu said that he held the map of Greater Israel and he was speaking about it, it clearly showed that nearly half of Saudi Arabia was part of that land. And I was asked a question by one of the Arab media outlets, and I said, I don't know why the Saudis don't want us to actually resist and they call our resistance terrorists, but if Netanyahu takes over Mecca, would they actually fight to defend their land? And instead of the Saudis basically attacking Netanyahu over what he said, they attacked me. They considered that I was hoping that the Israelis would take over the Saudi territories. So at the end of the day, so long that the Arabs fight one another at any point, the Israelis will just sit back and relax and basically just throw more sedition and watch us basically finish each other before they move in. The Israelis will move over to take over more lands, and if they don't control the lands, they don't have to control the lands. You have to understand, Greater Israel doesn't necessarily mean that the Israelis will have physical presence on the ground in control. What they can do is basically change the regimes or change governments or basically just install a puppet leadership that they can control, and then basically they will work through that. Look at Syria. And at the end of the day, if I would say something, I want to just rectify this notion. The Israeli entity is not a state under international law. Technically, it needs to have fixed borders with people on that land governed by a political body. They do have the people and they have the political body, but they don't have fixed borders. They still don't have fixed borders with Lebanon, and they still don't have fixed borders with Syria. That's why they are pushing Lebanon to sign a treaty to actually what you call redemarcate our land borders to fit their whims. And same thing with Syria. That's why they're taking more land at the moment before they sign over anything. They occupied 700 kilometers squared since the beginning of this year until now, and nobody has said anything from Syrian, southern Syrian territories. So when I look at the whole situation, we do have a rogue regime that's enabled by the international community to take over more lands from around its neighbors. And whenever those neighbors try to say no, they will call them terrorists.
All right, we're out of time for the show right now. Mick Napier, just quickly, if you may, in 30 seconds or less probably, how can the status quo change with the all-out support from Washington and most of all, the lack of accountability for Israeli crimes in the region?
Israel's criminal impulses are financed, supported by the collective West. Without that, they could not act as they do. And that's the bitter reality. The only antidote to that is a worldwide movement against the Zionist entity across the region. That will take the form of armed struggle and popular movements, but also around the world in America, Britain, Germany, France, etc. Growing resentment and anger towards Israel has led to thousands of arrests in Britain, thousands of arrests under so-called terrorism legislation. The mood is there to fight the Israeli state.
Okay.
Zionism a memory, but that's the only alternative to endless suffering for the people of the region.
Okay, that's the end for tonight's show. Thanks to activist and commentator Mick Napier joining us from Glasgow. Also thanks to journalist and political commentator Leila Hatoum speaking to us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. A special thanks to you for staying with us on Tradition of Spotlight. It's good night for now.
bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
Supplication is the wealth of the believer and the bridge by which one achieves proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Exalted.
A path to salvation, a way to connect the two worlds. On the program, Bridge.
You are listening to the program Bridge on Iran Radio with Sheikh Mahdi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdu wa thana' lillahi rabbil alameen. Wa salatu wa salam ala ashraf al-anbiya' wal-mursaleen, habib qulubana, tabib nufusana, abil qasim al-Mustafa Muhammad wa ala ali baytihi al-tayyibin al-tahirin. Respected brothers and sisters, please accept my warmest salams. And it's, again, always I mention it at the beginning of the program Bridge, that these few minutes is so much barakah in my life. It has been a source of blessings because it causes me and it makes me to contemplate and ponder on the du'as and supplications of the book Sahifa Sajjadiyah before presenting it to you in this program. And again, I felt so bad that it's been too late for me to seek refuge to this great legacy of Imam Zainul Abidin at this age. I wish I had sought refuge to Sahifa Sajjadiyah much earlier in my life. Had it been the case, it would have changed the path that I have took for a much better path. This is one of the regrets in my life. Anyhow, the 20th dua of Sahifa Sajjadiyah is the dua of Imam Zainul Abidin, his supplication on moral traits and acts pleasing to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Fi makarim al akhlaq wa mardiy al af'al. And it starts with this: Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alih. O Allah, bless Muhammad and his household. Wa balligh bi imani akmal al iman. And cause my faith to reach the most perfect faith. Waj'al yaqini afdal al yaqin. And make my certainty the most excellent certainty. And we talked about different levels of conviction and different signs of the believers, the people of certainty, in the past two sessions. This session, we're going to conclude with the final, the remaining signs of the people who are considered to be Ahl al-Yaqeen, the dwellers, the people of certainty and conviction, only after we take a break.
A path to salvation, a way to connect the two worlds.
The bridge between Allah and His creation.
A bridge that is meant to take us to Allah, to take us to His proximity. A bridge that is in the form of dua and supplication.
In this program, we offer commentary on the du'as of As-Sahifa As-Sajjadiyah of Imam Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam.
The famous book of litanies, the Psalms of Islam.
Bridge.
Respected brothers and sisters, Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, as under this phrase of the 20th dua of Sahifa Sajjadiyah, when Imam Sajjad alayhi salam asked Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to make his certainty to become the most excellent one, the most excellent level of certainty. Imam Amir al-Mu'min alayhi salam says in a beautiful hadith that as-sabru thamaratul yaqeen, right? One of the signs of a person who has certainty, right? Whether it's according to the level, like relative to the level of certainty, because we mentioned certainty has three levels. According and relative to the term, to the level of certainty that that individual has, right, you see these great characteristics and traits to be more visible and more apparent in them, more helping them more in the way of life. The commander of the faithful, Amir al-Mu'min alayhi salam, says, as-sabru, patience is thamaratul yaqeen. Sometimes we think that patience only is needed to reach the stage of certainty. Yes, an initial level of sabr and patience is required for you to get to the level of certainty. But once you are certain, once you're assured, once you have true faith, once you're completely having the conviction, what would you do? You will practice patience out of that certainty and iman and faith that you have. Patience as sabr in tribulations, in moments of obedience, in moments of hardships and difficulties, in the moments of disobedience of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, patience, right? When you come to avoid the disobedience of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, all three types of patience is the fruit of certainty. You don't say that bad word just because you're certain, you're assured, you have faith that there is a day of judgment. That if you do this, you have gone against the will and order and commands of and instructions of the Almighty Lord. It's the fruit of certainty. The second one is another beautiful hadith. Imam Amir al-Mu'min alayhi salam says, Silahul mu'min al-muqin, the weapon, right? Al-silahul muqin as-sabru ala al-bala. The weapon of the person with certainty is patience during affliction, right? That is the weapon of the believer to go through hardships, to go through difficulties, to go through tribulations. The weapon is what? It's the mean. It's the tool that you fight in the times of difficulty with. Imam says the weaponry, the tool for you to go through the times of difficulties, the times of hardship, the times of affliction is what? Patience, right? Patience is very important. وَالشُّكْرُ فِي الرَّخَاءِ, another sign of a believer, a true faithful, someone who has certainty, is gratitude during prosperity. Because what are we? The people who do not have certainty or who suffer from a weak level of certainty, when it comes to the time of prosperity, they forget Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the one who provided them prosperity. Let's take another break, and inshallah we'll come back to conclude this session.
You are listening to the program Bridge on Iran Radio.
All right, respected brothers and sisters, in this last portion of this session, a beautiful hadith from Imam Sajjad alayhi salam can help us conclude. And that is, he offered in the supplicatory prayer munajat before the Almighty Truth. He says, As'aluka bi karamik an tamunna alayya min ata'ika bima taqirru bihi ayni wa min raja'ika bima tatma'innu bihi nafsi wa min al-yaqeen bima tuhawwinu alayya musibat al-dunya wa tajlu bihi an basirati ghashawat al-ama.
The translation is this: O Allah, I ask of you by your generosity that you would bestow upon me from your gifts that which will cool my eye, bring me comfort, and from my hope in you, from my faith in you, that which will bring peace and tranquility to my soul, and from certainty, al-yaqeen, that which will ease the misfortunes of the world for me. Again, another sign of yaqeen, another product of yaqeen, another consequence of yaqeen is that the misfortunes, the difficulties, the problems, the hardships of this dunya will become easy for you to accept and to tolerate and to go through. And the last one: and remove the veils of blindness from my inner sight, give me basira, give me insight so I can see beyond the curtains. Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program Bridge on Iran Radio with Sheikh Mahdi.
Hargiz nagirat to abad aqa kasi jay to ra hargiz makhad az kaf dahan عشق و تولای تو را save the
Joining me this week is Leonid Savin. He is the chief analyst of the Sargat Institute, headed by the famed Russian philosopher Alexander Dugin. He's one of Russia's top experts on the multipolar world and spends most of his time traveling the world, Venezuela, Iran, and next week he's off to Cuba. Mr. Savin, thank you for joining me. First of all, has the multipolar world already arrived, and how do you see it developing?
It depends from what point of view we'll see on multipolarity. You know, there's different theories, different scholars introduced this term, for example, in the 60s, and American scholars like Deutsch, Singer, proposed one vision of multipolarity based mostly on positivist science. And of course, that pole means connected with physical geography. And in some sense, it's connected with bipolarity order. I mean, balance of Soviet Union and the United States at this time. So there is another point of view proposed, for example, by John Mersheim, the different types of multipolarity, unbalanced multipolarity or balanced multipolarity. There is point of view of nuclear multipolarity, that nuclear powers already kind of poles. Pakistan and Israel, in the sense, also actors of multipolarity. But for my opinion, it's better to rethink about what is pole. For example, I proposed in my book, Ordo Pluriversaris, point of view that Martin Heidegger told about pole. It's originally Greek word and also connected with polis, with politeia. And Heidegger told that it is kind of center of being of people. And his view, it is Greek people, but we also can speak about Iranian people, about Chinese people, about Russian people. And from this point of view, there's many poles.
Because it seems that the Western model, if you like, based around NATO, is a kind of empire that's run from Washington, of Europe increasingly becoming vassals of Washington. But is the idea of multipolarity, the idea that there is no center to this empire? You look at Russia, China, Iran, they have a kind of friendship, but they all have their own sovereign interests. Is that the difference between the multipolar world and the Western idea?
Yes, of course, and it depends on world view, because Chinese people not see the world future God like we Russians or Iranian people look on all these phenomena. And there's kind of a Western type of point of view to need to control the world, that only one Western civilization exists. And from our point of view, there are many civilizations. Chinese civilization, Iranian civilization, Turkish civilization, etc. And of course, there's kind of interest of to provide security for our sphere of influence. And if we speak about multipolarity, I see this contemporary moment like emerging multipolarity.
There's historically been a great deal of mistrust between Russia and Iran. How do you see their relationship now? Do you think it's strong enough to resist the Western desires to damage or destroy them both?
Yes, we have some historical conflicts between Persia and Russian Empire. But at the time, we have very good relations during the same period. For example, Russian troops assisted to suppress coup in Tigran in November 1916, when Turkish and German again tried to reorganize and to catch the power in Persia. And then it was time of Soviet Union, and of course, relation was not good because of Islamic revolutions. But then we developed very good economical, political ties on high level, and for last years we see that also kind of public diplomacy development between countries. Of course, we need more cooperate with Iranian people, and because we have the same vision on the global world to assist oppressed people, the same vision on Palestine, for example, the same vision on our common enemies like United States and collective West.
Because I was speaking to some Russian people, and there's an idea that Russia doesn't really understand Iran, or Iranian culture or history. You've been to Iran recently, I think a couple of years ago. How did you find the country, and what do you think could be done to create more trust between the two countries?
For Russians, ordinary people, Iran is an amazing country. It's a very ancient civilization, that very interesting to see different aspects, because it's not only one ethnic group. It's like Russia consists of many ethnic groups and many historical, cultural customs, tradition, etc. But for my opinion, for some last years, Kerzadegi is coming back. Idea of proposed Jalil Ali Ahmad, that the Iranian people are poisoned by the West, and now it seems a little bit pro-Western trends inside of Iran, and a kind of MTV television, kind of Western dress of woman, man, etc. And I think it's not good. But from another point of view, I think technical modernization is good for developing countries, despite of sanctions provided by the West against Iran.
Do you see Iran as strong at the moment? Are you impressed about in their war with Israel? Who won the war against Israel?
Of course, I am an external person who can analyze only by objective news coming from different sources. From my point, yes, and because Israel also stopped aggressions, and it seems that Iran held enough power to resist. And last news from different sources have kind of confirmation that Iran prepares for any type of new aggression and would like to be more stronger than before.
And has the United States, do you think, accepted the multipolar world under their new president, Donald Trump? Is Trump adjusting their policy back towards their own hemisphere? Should Venezuela be worried?
America First is not about multipolarity. It's very clear. Even during time of Barack Obama, they proposed the idea of leadership about multilateralism. It's kind of pseudo-multipolarity. And the United States, of course, seems like a leader of global war. And Donald Trump would like to reorganize foreign policy, first of all, back to South America. It's in Latin America, experts and analysts told that it's kind of doctrine Monroe number two. And so what Trump doing now, I mean, pressure on Venezuela, pressure on Panama, other countries. But he also interested in Asia, because the real economical rise in Asia, in China, in Japan, in Korea, for many years ago. So he very afraid the rise of China, and of course it's threat number one for the United States and for Trump. So he tried to balance, and how it possible, I don't know, because really economical system in the United States now is very weak. He tried to bring more of assault back to United States. Why he pressure on European Union at this idea of new tariffs, also pressure on Japan and other partners.
Do you think he's doing a good job, or do you think he's understanding that the world has changed? One journalist said to me in Asia that Trump understands the changing realities of the world, but everything he's doing is still damaging their interests.
I think nobody wants hot conflicts and new wars, but everyone understands that time of United States is